broadcasts something, it goes out and continues on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Hello and welcome to the Cottage Funk Podcast. This is Hot Off the Press with Andrea Richard
and Andrew Pillamai. And this is where we talk about recent news from the arts and sciences. Last week we had an interesting format for the podcast, and I think this week we're going to try something a little bit different. So instead of talking kind of in depth about four things each, we're going to give you the most interesting headlines we found from the internet, and then we're going to go deep on just two topics each. No, just one topic each.
One topic each. Two topics total.
Sweet. So give us some of the headlines that that caught your eye this week, Andrea.
So one thing that I thought was cool from this week is that there are these dragon tiles that were found in Vietnam as part of a palace complex archaeological dig.
Wait, dragon tiles?
They're tiles that are shaped like dragons. So they're ceramic tiles that have been enameled in green and yellow. And you can see pictures online. They look really dope. They're like actually super intricate and they're tube shaped. And
that's really cool.
Yeah. So like think about how terracotta tiles will kind of overlap in crescents.
Yeah.
Not crescents, but they're like half tube shapes, half cylinder shapes. It's like that, only they are dragon shaped. And so if you think about a terracotta tile roof that you can see, like my college campus has a bunch of them, but you can see them in a lot of neighborhoods around the U.S. where they kind of come down from the spine of the roof to the eave, I guess, in like a tube. They're like rows.
Oh.
So the very top is the tail, and the top tile looks like the tail end. And then the whole row is the body, and then the eave piece on the end is the dragon head.
So it's like all these dragons. Into a dragon.
Yeah. It's like a ton of dragons down there.
Have they dated it?
Yeah, so it's from the Li Dynasty, or the early Li Dynasty, which is around 980 to 1009. And they're really cool because these tiles match historical records of what the tiles should look like.
Oh,
which is like there's not very many examples of finding artifacts that have a corresponding and matching historical record.
Oh, right.
Which is really dope.
That's really dope. So one of the headlines I found was the LIGO station, which stands for, now get ready for this, Advanced Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
You lost me already. That's like a lot.
That's a massive name.
So what do they do? What's the deal?
So the LIGO station is essentially this lab where they bounce laser beams from two mirrors that are like 4 kilometers away from each other. And the reason they do this is so then they can measure these waves in the gravitational force. So they're essentially using this laser to measure activity that's happening out in space.
Oh, okay.
Like thousands of light years away. And as of late, they've been picking up these weird patterns in the sensors and whatnot. And they were like, this is not like any kind of gravity wave we'd be able to see.
Oh my god, aliens!
Aliens! They're coming.
The UFOs are on the way.
Well, maybe not UFOs, but ravens. They found out that ravens.
What?
Yeah. Ravens were flying down and they were pecking the ice off of the tubes used to shoot the laser. And the pecking from the ravens was actually, like, recorded by the instruments.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So here they were thinking, what on earth is this signal? When in reality, it was just a bunch of thirsty ravens pecking at the equipment.
That's really dumb, but also funny.
Yeah, right?
One thing I found this week was this guy, Roger Hjorns, is an artist from the UK who's been working on a long-term project where he buries planes. Which I thought I saw this and I was like, what the fuck? Yeah, he buries entire planes. They're planes that have been like retired planes.
So they're like not safe to fly anymore.
Yeah. So he's not like, he's sort of recycling them, but on the other hand, he's burying them in the ground. And what good is that doing?
Right.
So I don't understand this.
Now, does he have like a whole team helping him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say it's impressive if it's a one-man operation.
No, it's not a one-man operation. He has buried four so far. There's one in the UK. There's one in the Netherlands. No, in Holland, sorry. There's one in the Czech Republic. And there is talk of doing one in, I think, Nigeria. But the most recent one he buried was in Prague of last year. But the first one he did was in the UK, and it's okay. not a public space. Like, you can't go and see this thing.
So it's on private property?
It's, I actually don't know if it's on private property or not, but now it's just a field. Like, if you just went there, you had no idea that there was a plane there. Like, you can't go and see the plane. You can go to see where it was buried, and it's a field.
Is that at least, like, a plaque?
No. I don't think so. Don't quote me on that, but I'm not, I don't think that there is.
Well, that's fascinating, I guess.
I think it's an interesting commentary on, for outsiders looking in, on the way that performance art kind of is a little bit. Because it's something that happens in the moment and then it's done. And there's no evidence of it happening unless it's recorded in some way.
I like that. I'm also curious what people might think in like a couple thousand years when they unbury it.
Yeah, it's also kind of like we're providing more like earth pollution.
Pollution as well.
I read that the ones that he's put in the ground so far have been made sure that they're not leaking anything into the environment. That's good. But it's also like you're still burying a huge plane in the ground.
Yeah. It's like we could reuse those materials for something else.
Yeah.
Anyways, my next topic is about dogs. I got a lot of animal-related stuff.
Who doesn't love animals?
So, it was originally thought that the first dogs to come over had only kind of stayed...
Come over to where?
Oh, sorry. The first dogs to come into North America were sled dogs that came through from Siberia, over the land bridge, and down through Canada. However, they have recently found dog remains that are about 10,000 years old that are located in Illinois, which suggests that the dogs actually came over during another migration.
So does that mean that we thought before that the dogs came over with humans as sled dogs, but maybe they came over on their own?
Not necessarily on their own, but to serve humans in a different way than thought. So we do have dog remains that are older than 10,000 years old. But when we look at the bones, we can tell that it was cut up and it was cooked. So this was a dog that was being eaten. This is evidence that 10,000 years ago, people in North America were using dogs as companions. We're not necessarily sure whether they were work dogs or just pets to keep company, but they were buried intentionally and purposefully, and we can tell that they died of old age.
So that means that people were domesticating dogs as companions rather than as food earlier than we thought before?
Yeah.
That's cool.
So what's your next topic?
My next topic is on rock farts.
What?
I know. It's not actually rock farts, but rocks producing nitrogen. So there was a study that was put out by the University of California, Davis, that is basically saying that a quarter of the nitrogen in the atmosphere comes from Earth's bedrock, which we didn't really think about before. I feel like you know a little bit more about this type of stuff than I do. This is not really my subject area.
Oh, likewise. I've had a lot of archaeology topics.
That's okay. We can switch it around. It's all about learning, right? But I thought this was interesting because in the article that I read and the study, they're kind of saying that this might help explain why some natural ecosystems can absorb carbon dioxide at a higher rate than we think that they maybe should, because of the nitrogen that's being produced by the bedrock in those areas.
Yep.
It can also kind of change the way that we think about climate change.
Oh, very cool. So when a rock takes up an atmospheric gas, that's called sequestration, and it's part of a much larger cycle of sort of recycling and reusing all of the elements from the earth, the ocean, and the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And we've always understood there's been an equilibrium and a balance throughout the three, but it's interesting to hear that they're changing those numbers that everyone's been learning, and that they're learning there's new parts of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Cool shit.
So my last, like, top fast headline is about snow. We had a lot of it last week in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. And now it's gorgeous and sunny.
Oh my God, yes.
For Earth Day.
And this is a study from Ohio State University. So they were using the supercomputer Plidus over at NASA's headquarters to run these really intricate climate models in regards to North America and how much snow actually accumulates in North America. And they found it's actually a lot higher than previous estimations. And they calculated that every year in North America, we get about 1,200 cubic miles of snow every year.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so if you were to spread that out across all of North America.
At how thick?
It would be 7 inches.
7 inches thick, and it would cover the entire U.S. Or the entire continent.
The entire North American continent. So that includes Mexico. That includes all of the, like, islands in the Gulf. That includes the U.S. and Canada.
And the all of surface, the...
7 inches.
Oh my gosh.
But that's the
Greenland
average.
Included?
Oh, I'm not entirely sure about that. But this is interesting because the estimations and the calculations we have for flatland and prairies and whatnot,
mm-hmm,
is pretty accurate because of the satellites that we use to measure it. The tricky area is around the mountains, and essentially we found that much more snow is accumulating in the Rockies, especially the Canadian Rockies, than previously thought.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, my last topic isn't really something that I found, but actually a question I had for you, because everyone's been talking about this 500-year flood thing with the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah,
I mean, it kind of piggybacks on this snow situation.
So when people talk about a 100-year flood,
mm-hmm,
or a 5-year flood, essentially what they're saying is the river has reached a certain amount of its floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
So rivers take up much more space than what you initially think because of where it is this moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
But rivers encompass its entire floodplain at one point or another. And when you purchase a property, more often than not, they'll tell you what part of that plain, of that river's basin you're in. And if they say you're in a 100-year floodplain, all that means is that the probability says that part of the river basin will flood at least once in the next 100 years. So you can still have 600-700 year floods,
mm-hmm,
within 100 years.
But it's at least once.
But you'll definitely get it at least once, correct?
Okay, so this thing with the Mississippi River and the swell that's coming down?
Yeah, so the Mississippi River having a 500-year flood is more to do with how we're impacting the river basin. Because nowadays we have so much man-made anthropogenic infrastructure along the Mississippi River,
mm-hmm,
that there's nowhere for all of this excess water to go.
Because we've built up the entire floodplain in those areas.
Yeah, and we've tried to manipulate and mitigate where the water goes.
Mm-hmm.
So now what we're experiencing is further down the river, where usually it wouldn't be experiencing such impactful floods, it's getting amplified by all of that water that wasn't able to flood further up the river.
Hmm. So I feel like something like this happened when I was in college, because I went on a geology trip for a field course, and we drove from Atlanta to Texas, and we stopped along the way, and we went Baton Rouge, when it was all flooded, when the levees were breaking and everything. And it was massive, like, because you could track swell going down.
Yeah.
Was that, do you think that that was also a, like a 100-year flood situation, or is that kind of like the result that you would get from that situation?
So I think, I'm not sure what it, whether it be a 100-year flood, but it's definitely evidence that this amount of flooding is becoming way more frequent than it previously was.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Cool. Well, maybe we should take our break now. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be back.
See ya. Okay. Anyways, I want to go in depth about a topic near and dear to my heart, and I love learning more and more about it. So everyone knows the story of the Atlantic Thanksgiving, where Europeans came and interacted with North American indigenous tribes. But a lot of people don't know that there was also a Pacific Thanksgiving, where Polynesians and South Americans also had a similar exchange.
Wow.
And in this exchange, the Polynesians gave South Americans the chicken, and the South Americans gave Polynesians the sweet potato. And this is what's understood and accepted all around, like, Pacific studies.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a group that just revealed some DNA testing that they were doing, where they were checking the origins and like the migration that sweet potato took. And what they found out was that sweet potato may have been in Polynesia around 100,000 years ago.
So what does that mean for the Polynesian, or not Polynesian, the Pacific Thanksgiving?
So that means that sweet potato may not have necessarily been exchanged during Polynesians meeting up with South Americans. And they contest that the Polynesians may have never even interacted with South America. And to sort of support this idea, they also mention a similar test where they were looking at the DNA of chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And hypothesized that chickens may not have been brought to South America through the way of Polynesian explorers.
Whoa, so that's just like debunking the whole Pacific Islands Thanksgiving situation.
Without a doubt. However, there are a lot of skeptics in the field that say that there's a lack of data, and B, a lot of potential for mixing of data or poor data tracking. So I wanted to kind of look at exactly what it was they were doing. So the sweet potato has its closest relative being the Ipomoea trepida, which is a flower kind of similar to a morning glory.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, if you ever look at sweet potatoes, they kind of have those, like, cute little flowers on them.
I've never actually seen a sweet potato as a plant. And now I feel like I wish we had a garden so I could plant some sweet potatoes and discover this.
Exactly. Get some cute little flowers and a delicious meal.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking at the relationship between Ipomoea trepida and the sweet potato. And this isn't, like, a yam or a taro.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the generic orange sweet potato that we all
understand. Like what you get in the supermarket now.
Yeah, correct.
Gotcha.
And from their understanding, the amount of mutation and evolution that the sweet potato plant experiences, the sweet potato plants we see in Polynesia must have been there at least 100,000 years ago. So it's not that they found remnants or evidence of sweet potato 100,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's that according to this model and these calculations, that's when sweet potato should have been in Polynesia.
So this is a model and calculations based off of the mutations of this plant?
Correct.
Okay.
That's exactly what it is. And sort of changes and delineations in the DNA.
Hmm.
Now, chicken and sweet potato aren't the only pieces of cultural exchange that are seen across North and South America between Polynesians and indigenous American tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And to fully explain this, I kind of think it's important to cover all of the massive explorations that went down with Polynesians and canoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to start with Wite Rangora, who is a 7th century explorer from Rarotonga.
Mm-hmm.
And according to legend, he was the first person to reach Antarctica.
Wow.
And he
from came, the Polynesian islands?
Yeah, from Rarotonga.
Whoa.
And
so is Rarotonga known by a different name for people who aren't as educated in Polynesian culture, geography?
For better or for worse, you could just say he was from the like Maori region.
Okay.
Or from New Zealand.
Okay.
And he came back from this exploration saying that he found, as he said, Taiuka Aipia, or sea foaming arrowroot? Or sea foaming like arrowroot? And essentially he was saying there were rocks just being made from the water. Which is kind of what you would expect a person who's never seen ice to describe ice.
Okay, that makes so much more sense. I'm thinking of like volcanic stuff happening. Wow, okay.
If you look at how arrowroot foams up when you put it in water,
mm-hmm.
it kind of looks like mini icebergs.
I've never seen that, but I believe you.
Yeah.
So isn't arrowroot used in cooking sometimes for like a thickener or something?
I believe so, okay. Yeah. Also in 1886, when European explorers reached Antarctica, they in fact found Lapita pottery on the Antipodes Islands, which is kind of the outer islands of what we accept as Antarctica.
So Lapita is the group of people, now correct me if I'm wrong, but Lapita is the group of people that originated in the Polynesian Islands? Or came from mainland Asia to the Polynesian Islands? What's the deal?
It's believed that the Lapita people came from Taiwan down into the Philippines and then out towards Polynesia.
Okay.
And are the direct descendants of now Polynesians.
Okay. So when you look at like migration maps, we sort of talked about the migration of humans out of Africa last week.
Yep.
So this is like the Pacific Asian equivalent of that kind of thing.
Yep.
For the Pacific Islands, it would be Taiwan, Philippines, Polynesia.
Correct. And the only reason Polynesians aren't considered Lapita is because there was a shift from using rice as their main carbohydrate mm-hmm. to taro root. And that's kind of where a lot of anthropologists and archaeologists make the separation between Lapita and Polynesian.
So is that like a cultural shift? It's like a the Lapita culture was a relative of the Polynesian yeah. culture or an ancestor so. Of?
Yeah, an ancestor.
Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah. Another piece of evidence for broad exploration, much further than we had earlier expected from Polynesians, is if you look up in the islands of Canada, there's a small group of indigenous people that live on a island they have been calling Haida Gwaii, spelled G-W-A-I-I.
Mm-hmm.
And linguistics...
Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly. Linguists have linked this to the way Polynesians name their islands,
mm-hmm.
where Hawaii essentially means homeland. And then in Samoa, we also have Savatie, and there's also Savatie and like so many other variations of this same term.
Mm-hmm.
And in Canada, the Haida people have also given their island a similar name. And that's only the tip of the iceberg.
When isn't it comes there like to... dress or like outfit sort of similarities?
Yeah, it looks a lot like a lava lava.
Hmm.
Only a lava lava for a cold environment.
Right.
And a little bit in between Canada and South America, in South California, the Chumash people have got another piece of cultural exchange from Polynesians. where they have these woven canoes built from trees.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how do you have a woven canoe built from a tree? Are you using the fibers? Or?
It's kind of like a catamaran.
Okay.
Where it's a canoe and a limb that is all sort of binded together and woven together.
Okay, gotcha. So a catamaran is a canoe that has like an arm that goes out, and then there is a parallel sort of anchor type thing. It also floats, it's not like weighing it down, but it's like a parallel rudder that sticks out from the side. So
yeah, and okay. It's also the parent vehicle of now like contemporary catamarans as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chumash people in South California have these woven canoes, and not only are they built the same as Polynesian canoes, they share a similar name. So in Hawaiian it's Kumala'au,
mm-hmm.
and in Chumash it's Tomalo'o.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at both of them written down, it's
Tomalo'o sounds like it's Polynesian.
Word. Without a doubt. And even when we look at the name of the sweet potato, the Andean Aztecan word for sweet potato is kumara,
mm-hmm.
while the Polynesian term for sweet potato is kuvala.
And when I was in New Zealand, they called their like version, I guess, of sweet potato, because it didn't taste exactly like a sweet potato, but very, very similar, was kumara.
Yeah.
So you get like kumara chips if you got fish and chips. So fucking good.
So the Pacific Thanksgiving is definitely being contested right now. But there's a lot of evidence arguing for the Pacific Thanksgiving actually happening.
But without a doubt, the Pacific Islanders were like baller explorers on the ocean.
Oh my god, yeah. They used bird migrations and they used star maps. They even used swells in the ocean to understand exactly where they were going. So ancient Polynesian sailors and sea navigators, they would have women. It was always a woman that was the navigator. And her role was to lay down on the bottom of the canoe, and she would be able to feel where the canoe was leaning.
Whoa, is she just like laying on her back or something? Yeah.
And just by laying on her back and being able to understand with all the waves and everything which way the canoe's leaning, she would be able to understand where along the ocean swell she was and be able to navigate to other islands just solely from that.
That's really cool. So this is a slightly off topic, but was it women? Because I know that we've sort of talked about this before, just you and I, but about how women kind of have one foot in this world and one foot in like
potentially
the spirit world kind of thing. So they're like maybe a little bit more connected to what's going on.
There's definitely an understanding that women have a deeper root and are closer to like the earth than men are, mm-hmm. in many Polynesian cultures, for sure.
Interesting. That's really cool. Lady power.
Yeah. So we'll leave that on the table.
So my topic that I wanted to cover briefly is about a hinge that was uncovered.
Ho-ho.
Yeah. Dusted off. In Rounds, Northamptonshire, at Warth Park. So, do you know what a hinge is?
So, when I think of a hinge, I think of RuneScape, and I think of like these druids kind of like building these cool dueling arenas where they like cast spells at each other and shit. That's what I think of a hinge as.
That's very fantastical, and I like it, but it's very sort of wrong. Yeah. So henges are, so when you say henge, everyone thinks of Stonehenge, or they think of like the henge in Outlander where Claire is transported to another time.
And there's like these huge
standing stones. And like, yeah. So everyone thinks of standing stones when they think of henges, but that's not actually what makes a henge a henge. A lot of henges have standing stones. Yeah. So a lot of henges have standing stones, but what makes a henge is actually the earth embankment around it. So
shut up.
Yeah.
You're blowing my mind. So you're saying you can have a henge that doesn't even look like a henge?
Well, what you think of as a henge. It's a henge. It just doesn't look like Stonehenge.
Oh.
So a henge is usually circular. Sometimes it's a full circle. Sometimes it's like two crescents pointing towards each other. Sometimes it's four pieces, like four chunks that are all sort of crescent shaped that kind of create a circle.
Cool.
That are earth embankments. And then inside of that, there's a ditch. And then inside, within the ditch is a flattened, raised area. And that's where you usually find the standing stones. So Stonehenge, everyone goes to the stones, but the actual site is much larger.
Okay.
And it does have the ditch, and it does have the embankment.
I think I've seen, like, satellite images of Stonehenge.
And yeah, that's the best way to find it. And that's actually how this henge was discovered back in the 70s, was via aerial photography. So
this was found in the 70s, but has only just been unburied?
Yep. That's why it's news now. So it was found in the 70s, it was partially studied in the 80s and 90s, and now they've uncovered the whole thing, which is kind of cool. Study is still going on, they're still doing digs and stuff, they do test trenches and everything, but I thought it was an interesting thing to think about, that not all henges look the way that we think henges look, because we've been conditioned by, sort of by the media, sort of by, like, popularity of archaeological sites like Stonehenge.
So do you think there's a potential that we may have completely wiped out
without a doubt
henge sites
without a doubt, without even realizing. Within the British Isles there are around 1300 henges that have been recorded. Wait for it, but an estimated 4,000 that were originally there. So
that are just no longer
they're just not there anymore.
That's
because
really,
if you think about it, everyone thinks of the British Isles as being rolling green hills and grassland and pastures, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how it was. It was all forest.
All forested, yeah.
So humans have completely changed the landscape of the British Isles. And with that comes the destruction of ancient sites, including henges.
Yeah, definitely.
So there is a really famous henge in the Orkney Islands, I believe. It's not a henge, I'm sorry. There's a really famous site in the Orkney Islands that was discovered because this couple was like, you know, there's this paddock here and we really like it, but we want to make a prairie with flowers so that we can have birds and native plants here and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were plowing, and on the very last turn of the plow, they uncovered this, like, cornerstone, basically.
No.
Yeah, and if they had had a plow that was any deeper, they would have, like, destroyed, like, this archaeological evidence. And it's turned out to be one of the biggest sites for that region. Now, I didn't do the research on this topic, so I don't remember exactly when the dates were for this. But it, like, that site basically showed archaeologists and anthropologists how big of a cultural center the Orkney Islands were.
Wow.
Like, it's massive.
That's frightening to think about.
Like, and think about all of the civilizations that are there under your feet, and you just don't know that they're there.
Definitely. It definitely exposes why it's so important to have people survey land and check it out before we could build stuff on it.
Rescue archaeology is what it's called. When you go in and you do a survey on a site before a building goes down.
Yeah.
In a lot of places, you have to legally have that done.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, when I was in the Caribbean, like, ages ago, between high school and college, we kind of stumbled across this group of archaeologists that were doing, like, they were sifting through soil samples, and they were like, yeah, you can come help us, whatever, it's fine. Like, they were just, like, taking volunteers, and so we sat there for a few hours in the sun sifting through this stuff, and we were finding all kinds of stuff. You were finding
just
pipe
right
stems from colonial era, you're finding glass, you're finding beer bottle parts, but you're finding all this cool stuff. And they were doing it because there was a building that was supposed to go up, and they were doing the archaeology before they started the building stuff on it.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. Rescue archaeology is underrated.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Well, I think I've got all my topics off my shoulders.
Yeah,
off my
me
chest.
Too, for this week.
So, thank you to all of you for listening to The Cottage Punk. And this has been Hot Off the Press. Be sure to like us, follow us, and subscribe to the podcast.
And we will have more information about all of these topics we've discussed on the Cottage Punk website. If you want to read more, if you've had your curiosity sparked.
Yeah, and you just want to keep on reading and keep on learning.
We'll have links there so you can delve in.
All right, thank you. Sayonara.
Until next week.